Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Hi, it's Anne Wilson here, and I'm delighted to host Emerge Australia's podcast series for 2026, brought to you during ME Awareness Week. I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and pay my respects to elders past and present, and those listening to this podcast, noting your continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. When I consider the times in which we live, the lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine seem to resonate with what I'm sure we all wish for, and that is a world where the brotherhood of man is celebrated globally, a peaceful world, a world without war, a world without stigma or discrimination, and a world where we have equity of access to healthcare treatments, clinical services, and cures. Visionary lyrics from John Lennon, written in 1971, and they're as relevant today as they were then. Lots of food for thought there. In this series designed to focus on post-exertional malaise, or PEM, our key theme for World ME Awareness Week, I'm delighted to interview people with ME-CFS and those with lived experience of PEM, the hidden harm of trying harder. This podcast series may include discussions on sensitive topics, including mental health and other health-related information, and some listeners may find this content confronting, triggering, or challenging. The information shared is intended for general informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice, so listener discretion is advised. So today, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Camille Williams. Camille, who is one of our wonderful nurses who works on our patient information and support line, commenced the role of telehealth nurse in May 2022. She has a nursing background in oncology and she's worked in support services for the Leukemia Foundation. Camille has a strong connection with people who live with ME-CFS and personal experience of living with an invisible illness. Due to her personal journey, she can empathise and have some understanding of what people with an invisible disability, their families and carers experience. And I can absolutely vouch for the fact that so many of you send emails to us about the exceptional support that you have received from Camille in her role. So Camille, welcome to today's podcast.
Thanks for having me, Anne.
Such a pleasure. So Camille, you have a background in oncology nursing and now work as our telehealth nurse. How has your previous experience in oncology influenced your approach to caring for people with ME-CFS and understanding their needs?
So I think there's a connection where people who have cancer of some sort, they are diagnosed and their lives are tipped on their heads, all their normal has changed. And I think that's the same thing for people living with ME-CFS and long COVID. I suppose the big difference with people looking after people in oncology and looking after people with ME-CFS is that fortunately, for people who have cancer, there's a clear diagnosis pathway, treatment management, things that we have to do clearly. And unfortunately, that isn't the case for people with ME-CFS. So there's quite a big difference there. But some of the things that are the same is that for people going through treatment who have a diagnosis of cancer is they require some energy management, pacing, and it's all about respecting people's individual limits.
Yeah, that's so important, isn't it? That whilst the energy limitations of people with cancer and other diseases are there, they're not really their primary diagnosis. So, you know, when someone has cancer, that's their primary diagnosis. People with ME/CFS may have had an infection. They may have had Epstein-Barr virus. And then suddenly they find out that their battery has no energy and they have no way of replenishing that energy, which is a little bit different, isn't it?
Yeah, it is actually quite different. So I suppose where the difference lies is post-exertional malaise and fatigue, and they're quite different, which a lot of people think don't realise. A lot of people in the community obviously understand this, but people outside of the community don't realise that post-exertional malaise and fatigue are not the same thing. So people with a lot of different diagnoses, not just cancer, many different things, experience fatigue. But this isn't the same thing as post-exertional malaise. And yes, some of them may go on eventually receive a diagnosis of ME/CFS, but for the majority, they are experiencing, let's say, cancer-related fatigue. And after a period of time, that fatigue resolves with a few different strategies that they can put in place. So there is that big misunderstanding about the difference between fatigue and post-exertional malaise, unfortunately.
Yeah. So you've brought post-exertional malaise into this discussion now, and of course, you know, the hidden dangers of trying harder for us, you know, what it feels like, what a crash means, you know, whether it's just physical exertion or mental exertion, and how PEM actually impacts the daily lives and activity of people with ME/CFS.
Yeah, I think, again, that's a big misunderstanding, that PEM is only triggered by physical and maybe cognitive exertion, but actually everything, emotional exertion, it could be cognitive, physical, it could be orthostatic, it could be environmental as well. So that's the difference with PEM. Everything is causing your battery to be decreased. It's not just one simple thing that we can eliminate. Everything coming in from all directions causing your battery to be drained, I suppose.
And so how does someone distinguish and how does someone identify what it is that's draining their battery?
It's a really great question, and it's a really tricky thing to distinguish, because post-exertional malaise likes to be really difficult and it can be delayed. So something that you did 12, 24, potentially even 72 hours ago might be affecting you on that day. So it can be really tricky to figure it out. Some people can find a bit of a pattern by keeping a bit of a symptom diary. They track what they've been doing and what symptoms they might experience over a period of time. And you might be able to find a little bit of information that points to certain things causing you post-exertional malaise, or maybe things, let's say you go for a 5-minute walk, that might cause you immediate post-exertional malaise. Let's say you need to write a few emails on your laptop, that might cause post-exertional malaise to happen in 24 hours. So you might be able to find a little bit of a pattern, but some people unfortunately can't find a pattern, and it seems to be really, the word I'm looking for, sorry, it's gone out of my head. It's really unpredictable, unfortunately. So it can be really tricky to work out what your triggers are and how they affect you. But it is possible.
And if you've done that, what are some of the strategies that someone can use? Let's say you are doing some work on your laptop. Do you have to eliminate that altogether to avoid being in PEM? Or can you pace yourself with that? How do you deal with that? You know, if it's something that you need to look to do every day, how does the patient?
There are some people, for whatever reason, might be more severe and they are unable to tolerate any time on a screen. But some people are able to tolerate short periods of time on a screen. So then we would talk about processes where you might pace yourself. You might find that if you do your administrative tasks over the whole day in 10 minutes first and have enough rest breaks and make sure you are taking time away from the laptop, from the screen, you might be able to manage those things. It really depends on the individual person. People find adjusting the brightness on their screen, for instance, maybe using night mode on things might be beneficial as well. So sometimes it's a little bit of playing around with different strategies to see what might work for you.
Yeah, I think that's an important point for our listeners that, you know, there's no one size fits all. We absolutely know that there's not one thing that will help everybody because everybody's ME/CFS is very unique. But hearing that, you know, you can try different things to see whether you get less PEMmed and are able to cope maybe in shorter periods of time, etc., has got to be comforting, I would think.
Yeah, 100%. And I think you're really correct with that. Again, there's no one size fits all, and we need to sometimes play around with different strategies and what might work really amazingly for one person, unfortunately, might not be the best strategy for you, but we just might have to look around to find the strategy that works for you.
Yep. So, Camille, ME/CFS, of course, is one of the invisible diseases. You know, people, you can't tell that someone's got ME/CFS, which has got to be extremely challenging. As someone with personal experience of living with an invisible disability, what are some of the challenges you've faced and continue to face? And how can we as a society better support and understand people with an invisible illness?
So I think the biggest challenge is being believed. And this is the thing that I hear day in and day out from people is that, I mean, I think I would say 99.9% of people, I'm not going to say 100% people with ME/CFS because some people are able to find the odd unicorn of a doctor who believes them straight away. But I would say 99.9% of people who we speak to will say being believed and not being believed is the biggest challenge. So really they're speaking to people, sometimes not just doctors, family members, friends, and people aren't believing them, and they're sort of having to really push for a diagnosis or push for management strategies, and because people putting their own ideas onto what's happening for whatever reason, and they're not believing what the person is saying. So I think one of the biggest challenges is that is being believed. The unpredictability of an invisible disability makes it really tricky when there might be times where you can function okay or pretty well. Then there are times that you might not be able to function so well or not be able to function at all. And so that unpredictability of when those days might happen is really tricky to navigate, because all the normal sort of strategies you might put in place, I'm going to say like a return to work plan, for instance, you know, there's this idea that you break your leg, you can't be in the office, but you'll have a return to work in 6 weeks, and it's a build up of a certain period of time, and in 3 months you'll be totally fine and you'll be working in the office full time again. But that's just not possible for people living with ME/CFS and long COVID because of the unpredictability that they experience every day.
Yeah, it's a challenge, isn't it? I guess it's a challenge just planning your life. I mean, and I guess when we hear what a lot of patients tell us, you know, they say that they've really lost the life that they used to have. Do you get that a lot on your calls where people just despair that they can't do the things that they used to be able to do?
Yes, definitely. It's the theme that we hear all the time. And it's all about that sort of adjustment of how you think and how you sort of manage. But it's something that we hear all the time. And I feel like that is something that society and we can do to support people in this challenge. I feel like society has sort of always rewarded this pushing through sort of mentality and this idea that people are so strong because they persevere. And this leads to a lot of guilt and a lot of shame, I think, for people living with post-exertional malaise when they aren't able to keep pushing through and to keep doing these things. And I think as society, we need to change that rhetoric around this whole, oh, you know, you're doing so well because you're pushing through and getting through things. I think that's really dangerous rhetoric, especially for people living at MECFS.
Yeah, and I guess that's where I love the theme of our podcast series, which is the hidden harm, you know, and the hidden harms of trying harder, trying to push through. It seems to be like almost a cultural norm, isn't it, that people say, oh, you know, you've fought the good fight. Yeah, you got there in the end. Yeah. And we don't really necessarily think of the impact of that kind of rhetoric, as you put it, on people who've got no control over their energy limits. And can you talk to us a little bit about what the words hidden harm means? What does that, so people go into PEM if they push harder and try hard, but what actually happens to them when they do that? I mean, what happens in their bodies when they go, they'll go into PEM, but what is happening internally for them when they're in that situation?
So I suppose at the start, people have potentially that ability to actually be able to push through to a certain degree. They might have started experiencing some symptoms, but they're able to do a few things. And as time goes on, their body's ability to actually recover to the same baseline that it was at decreases. And eventually, when you keep pushing through, eventually your body says no more, can't do it. And a lot of people experience these really big factors where they're able to not really do anything. They might be bedbound or housebound and start experiencing a huge amount of symptoms, or their symptoms have really exacerbated. So I suppose that's an important point to make as well, that some people, you might think, okay, well, I'll just continue on with this push-crash cycle because it sort of works to a certain degree, but we do see that stops working quite quickly, unfortunately, and that people's baselines just gradually get worse and worse, and suddenly their body says, no, I can't do it anymore, and their baseline might be quite bad for a period of time. So internally, it's, I suppose, different for everyone. It depends on what symptoms people experience and the symptoms that are being exacerbated. So, I mean, commonly we hear people experiencing different symptoms of potentially orthostatic intolerance. They might have a lot of dizziness, heart palpitations, feeling lightheaded. Some people might faint. There might be people's symptoms might exacerbate. They might experience an increase in joint pain, muscle pain, muscle aches, whole body heaviness. People describe that feeling of being encased in cement, or like every time they're trying to move, they're sort of wading through water, really feeling of real heaviness. People, I mean, the list goes on with different symptoms. And sometimes we can narrow the symptoms down to different sort of body systems. And those body systems, there might be something that we can do about those symptoms. There might be different management strategies for certain things that are happening. Some things might just be purely related to your body not being able to produce energy in the correct way, or enough, or your cells just literally malfunctioning and not able to produce the amount of energy that's required. And that's different that's every single person, unfortunately, how much energy they're able to produce. But yeah, sorry, that was a bit of a tangent.
You know, it was a good tangent because, you know, that we know that so many people get told, well, you know, it's all in your mind. You know, this is psychosomatic. Mm. You know, it's not really physiological at all. You're just tired or whatever. But the reality is that we know because we've got the evidence of what's happening in a person's mitochondria. We know. Yeah. Even now, and as the evidence from Edinburgh University came out last year, that through Chris Ponting, that, you know, there are areas of the human genome that are different to healthy controls. So we know that there is also a genetic link. And I guess that knowledge, I don't know, if I was a patient with ME/CFS, knowing that it's absolutely physiological, that I'm not making it up, that I, you know, would be really precious, because we know that cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, has been described as much as graded exercise therapy, and often for the wrong reasons. What would you have to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think what I see quite often is people still will say to me, they'll talk to me and they'll say, oh, you know, I feel so thankful that you've told me that this is a biological process going wrong. Something is happening that is going wrong, because even they themselves have been so conditioned to believe that this is in their head still, you know, and doctors telling them, unfortunately, still, well, no, it's just your anxiety. So someone who might have previously experienced anxiety before being diagnosed with ME, and then the doctor saying, oh, no, this is all because of your anxiety. And sometimes my response is, well, you're the best person to actually know this. You've experienced anxiety previously, so you know that this feels completely different and that there's a complete difference between the two. So we do hear that all the time, that people, even themselves, even though they might know, they might have read somewhere, someone's told them that it's a biological process, they still have that feeling that this might be happening, might be in their head. And so I spend some time talking to quite a lot of people about the fact that, no, this is something going wrong biologically, and this is definitely not in your head, and you can't just think your way out of it. Yeah, which, I mean, amazing. If we could do that, that'd be brilliant. But yeah, unfortunately, that's not the case.
Yeah, it must be really difficult. I have had experience of that many, many years ago in my life as a very severe asthmatic, person with asthma who had life-threatening asthma. And I was told, it's all in your head. And so, you know, when you're feeling absolutely dreadful, to be told it's all in your head, it's just like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, it isn't all in my head. These symptoms are real symptoms. So our patients have been so gaslit for so long that it is a huge challenge. So I'm going to ask you a question now about education, and you deliver educational programs around PEM. Do we deliver education programs around PEM to GPs? I mean, what do we need to do with our education to ensure that our clinicians understand PEM as well as our patients?
Yeah, so we do deliver education to GPs. I don't personally do that, but through our clinical educator, she provides that education to GPs. I think that the education that we provide is exceptional. I often wonder if it comes down to, I don't know, society, and there are some doctors who don't want to believe that this is happening, maybe. I'm not sure. That might be the case, potentially, for some people. But yes, we do have an education for GPs and for allied health professionals and different doctors if they want to log in via our website and complete the education. There are modules there that they can complete. I myself do education for people living with ME/CFS and long COVID, and their carers or family members if they want to do the education as well. So the education that I provide is based off the modules that we have available. So we created some educational modules with collaboration with the Bateman Horne Centre. So if you wanted to find them, if you've never seen them before, you can navigate through our website and find them sitting there, Learn with Emerge Australia in the Bateman Horne Centre. So there are quite a few different modules there. And I also do some live sessions based on those modules, one of them being on post-exertional malaise. So it's not a prerequisite to attend. You don't have to complete the module, to attend these live sessions. The module's there if you want some extra information. So if you wanted to attend one of these sessions, again, they're on our website. You can navigate through what we do and then under online live education sessions. And if you press the link there, you can pre-register or you can just attend when it's on. And I usually provide a short 20-ish minute education on whatever the topic is, post-exertional malaise being one of them. And then we have time to have conversation and discussion with the other people who are attending around different things that people might have questions on.
Do you get feedback from patients on that education, that it's been helpful, that it's hit the spot, etc.?
We do, yes. And most of the feedback is very positive and people find it really helpful. People also find it really helpful having that discussion with other people who are experiencing the same things that they're going through and just getting some new ideas around what they might find helpful.
It really is very comforting, isn't it, when you are going through something like ME/CFS or any illness for that matter, to hear that other people are going through something similar and try to compare experiences. I think it reduces isolation. Do you think that?
Yeah, 100%. I think when you have ME/CFS or long COVID, you can be extremely isolated. So many people aren't able to leave home. A lot of people aren't even able to really connect much, maybe even online or having phone conversations. And so it's an extremely isolating condition. So having that connection with other people can be extremely beneficial. Even just knowing that there's other people experiencing the same thing can sometimes be helpful.
I think that'd be amazing, amazingly helpful and reassuring more than anything else. So many individuals with ME/CFS also have to navigate the challenges of being a carer, having a family, etc. How can we ensure that the needs of both the patient and their caregivers are met, and what support systems or resources would you recommend for families dealing with ME/CFS?
So it's really tricky. In Australia, our support systems, unfortunately, aren't hugely amazing for people living with these conditions. And so a lot of, most people rely on that sort of family support that is for being their carers. So there are a couple of things that I would say for people. Even if you just get onto our website, we have some really good information for carers, some really good explainers for people, for schools, for employers and things like that, some really good information that you can give other people if you don't have the energy yourself to maybe try and explain everything. I would say for carers, reaching out to Carer Gateway can be really beneficial for them as well. We also have support groups through Emerge Australia for carers as well. So I think that is a hugely beneficial thing for carers, because people with ME/CFS are hugely isolated. Their carers can also become hugely isolated when they're providing care to someone living with ME/CFS. And so speaking to someone else who is going through the same thing, caring for someone with ME/CFS, can be really, really supportive and really nice to those carers as well. So I would definitely recommend looking at those if that is something that you think would benefit you.
Yeah. I think peer support, whether it's patient to patient or carer to carer, is really critical because, as we said, it reduces isolation. But sometimes when you hear what someone else is doing to deal with a problem that you're dealing with yourself, you go, oh, I never thought of that.
Yep. 100% agree with that. we talk about that in, you know, even the groups that I run for post-exertional malaise for patients and their carers, you know, it's great to pick up little tips and tricks from other patients, something they might have randomly tried that has been hugely beneficial, and who knows, it might also work for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Camille, finally, what advice would you give to someone who's recently diagnosed with ME/CFS or maybe has ME/CFS and hasn't had a diagnosis, which is more like the way it is?
Mm.
They're feeling overwhelmed and unsure of where to turn for support and information.
So, first off, make an appointment with us. There's a few of us and we're there to help you navigate what's happening. So I definitely recommend that if you've never come across the support service at Emerge Australia. But really start off by trying to slow down as much as you possibly can. Try not to push through as much as you can if possible. Really trying to modify how you might do things and really trying to add as much rest as possible into your day. Like we spoke about earlier, you might still have that ability to push through slightly and, you know, you think, oh, well, I might just keep pushing through. It might go away. But we know that, unfortunately, that doesn't keep working for most people. So really trying to slow down as much as possible if you can. And you might need an extended period of rest at this point when you're newly diagnosed. That might also happen, and that's okay. And trying to factor that in as much as you can. Trying to remember as well, and this is going to sound really strange potentially to some people, but probably will make sense to a lot of people, is on the days that you feel better are usually the days that you can do the most damage, because that is usually when you can push through the most. And then, unfortunately, in the next couple of days when delayed HEM happens. So try and remember to modify and add your rest breaks in on those days that you do feel like you have a little bit more energy, instead of trying to rush around and complete all those tasks that you might think need to be completed on those days. And also, if possible, again, not everyone has this around them, but try to build a small group of people who you can try and teach a little bit about what you're experiencing, whether that's providing our explainer, providing them maybe with a little bit of information about what might support you during PEM. You know, it might be that you prefer to be communicated with via text. It might be that you can't tolerate much noise, so you'd prefer that they write you a note. You might need certain medications when you feel worse. You might prefer to be alone. You might not like physical touch. There might be a whole lot of different things that might work for you. And so if you can, if there's a few people around, carers, friends, potentially healthcare professionals, try and build a little team that have a little bit of understanding about what you might need during PEM.
Well, that all sounds like very sound, very solid advice. Of course, we know that everybody's ME/CFS is unique. An interview that I did with someone else recently, they talked about really planning out their day in such a way that they scheduled rest and, you know, were quite disciplined about what they had to do and when, even down to foods that they eat. Have you got any comment about that?
I think that works really well for some people. I think it does and maybe works so well for some people. In some ways, I agree for a lot of people that scheduling can be really beneficial, because if we rely too much on listening to our body's signals, some signals can be missed or ignored quite easily. So when we schedule rest, we sort of take that whole thing out of the equation. We take the whole listening to your body out of the equation. So I actually talk about scheduling rest quite often with patients, and I think it can be really, really beneficial. I think scheduling, looking at your week or even your month as a whole, can be really helpful, because, for instance, you might have an appointment on Friday. So then in the days leading up, you might want to make sure that you're not doing too many really strenuous activities, because you know that that appointment is going to take a lot of energy to attend. So on Monday, you might do a few tasks. On Tuesday, you might do a few smaller tasks. And then Wednesday and Thursday, you might make sure that you have less tasks scheduled into your diary, so you can charge your batteries up as much as possible to be able to attend the appointment on Friday. And then you might try and avoid having longer tasks that you need to do on the Saturday and Sunday to try to recover to a certain point after that appointment on Friday. So I'm not sure if that's
all. I just thought it was worth mentioning, that's all, because I think everything you said is just so pertinent and really important. And our listeners will take what they need out of the comments that you've made. So I just want to thank you for your time with us today. And I do hope that our listeners have found that informative and helpful. And of course, you can contact Camille and the rest of our patient support team via our online details. So thank you. Today's podcast is part of our World ME Awareness Week series that Emerge Australia is recording with those who live with ME/CFS, and in Camille's case, those who work with people who have ME/CFS. This is a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID in Australia. If the content of this or other Emerge Australia podcast has triggered an emotional response for which you need assistance, feel free to contact Lifeline on 131114, their Crisis Support and Suicide Prevention Service. You may also wish to go onto the Emerge Australia website, where emergency services are listed. Tune in again for our next interview, and don't forget, for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter, where we've got lots of information about everything that we do at Emerge Australia and more, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au. Camille, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure having you on, and bye for now.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I hope someday you'll join.